On va enchaîner tout de suite avec Rhonda Valstein qui va parler de ce que j'avais déjà annoncé. Donc je ne répéterai pas ma présentation. Nous allons donc l'entendre parler de la Vénus de Milo et de la littérature dans l'histoire de la Révolution grecque.
Well, let me add my voice to the chorus of gratitude for a wonderful conference, beautifully organized. Thank you to Edem and also to Veronique, who's taking care of all the details. This has really been spectacular. And I'll speak in English because my whole academic life revolves around English and Greek. So here we are. I bring up for you the map of the Greek world, let me call it this way. And the map is from 1801, but I will be focusing on 1820, which is just about 1 year before the outbreak of the Greek Revolution. And then for the Greek state to be formed takes another 10 years. That takes us to 1830. So this is about the temporal framework we will be working in. My paper focuses on the sculpture of the Venus de Milo, which is a chance find of 8 April 1820, but also a token discovery amidst the growing tensions between the Ottoman administrative hierarchies, Greek intellectuals, and aspiring revolutionaries. And let's not forget the local populations of the Greek lands, in this case, the Aegean or Cycladic island, the little island of Milos. I'm always surprised when I ask my students what's in the name of the Venus de Milo. They think that Milos was some sort of a Renaissance collector. So much for forgetting about the local context. Milos is a Cycladic island, not the best known one, but an island nonetheless. So the key agent who transported the Venus statue from Milos to eventually Paris was the French diplomat Comte de Marcellus. He has a very long name, lots of first names, but it ends with de Marcellus, and I will call him Marcellus, who, according to the Greeks, stole the statue. But according to himself and the French, he rescued it from oblivion, or even worse, destruction. In Marcellus's telling of the adventurous acquisition history of the Venus de Milo, the islanders of Milos have all been erased, and their motivations have been undermined and distorted. Given that our Marcellus wrote for about 40 years, time and again, about the Venus, he had a lot of time on his hands to shape the narrative, which is exactly what he did. So I argue that Marcellus did more than just orientalizing the hostile stand of von Milos. He not only took the Venus along, he also thoroughly repossessed her by embedding her in both classical and contemporary literary tropes. He made the Venus symbolic of a modern Greece that he then depicted as backward, if not barbaric. At the same time, he depicted an ancient and classical Greece in opposition to the modern Greece, which was for him forever the land of Homer. And that classical land, not the modern Greece, could viably be resurrected in the impending Greek Revolutionary War. The struggle for Greece's independence from the Ottoman Empire begins nominally in March 1821, but there are a lot of stirrings going on beforehand, so the writing is on the wall. And of course, when it finally happens, this independence struggle will be carried out with close oversight and intervention of the great powers, and royalist France was certainly part of that. It had not yet given up on its imperialist ambitions. The other big powers are, of course, Britain and Russia. So the Venus de Milo lacks an ancient history. This is interesting. We do not have any single reference, not a text, not an inscription, absolutely nothing before she is discovered on what we presume is the 8th of April, 1820. She is what we call in Latin a tabula rasa, a blank slate. That also means she has no history of superstition associated with her. She literally comes out of the ground one day with no prehistory. But soon romanticist treasure hunting, Orientalist literature, and Greek revolutionary history start to blend in what is the statue's new lease on life, which is quintessentially a Western afterlife in literature that becomes legend as well as history. Marcellus was most instrumental in erasing the statue's Eastern Mediterranean past for deliberately silencing the agency of the locals. So when Greek nationhood is at stake here, the Greek voices of the past are permitted, but not those of the contemporaries. There was no place or audience either for Greek arguments about the value of the Venus as a token of antiquity, but also the Venus as potentially an instrumental tool in the making of a modern Greek national and cultural identity. But when French nationhood is at stake, then the past is presented as coherent and unified for the sake of the French national cause. Mind you, in 1820, this comes at a pretty turbulent episode in French history as well, not exactly a model of cohesion and unification, but no more words necessary there. So I argue that Venus was the product in the end of a brutal local uprooting, yet for Marcellus, the statue had to prove paradoxically France's physical rootedness in the classical legacy and therefore its Western identity at the expense of the Greeks. So who is this Marcellus? Here he is. How does he look upon the Greek world and its inhabitants? Well, he always espoused a Hellenism whose pedigree he could trace back to Homer. He is, of course, classically trained. He is the what we know as the French diplomat Comte de Marcellus, who lived from 1795 through 1865, and who traveled very early in his mission in the Eastern Mediterranean. He traveled to the island of Chios, which is right there on the frontiers between Eastern Mediterranean and modern-day Turkey, because he goes in search of the famous school of Homer. Like many romantic travelers, Marcellus wanted to see the island where Homer was presumably born and where he spent presumably the latter part of his life teaching. And visitors to the island of Chios were shown Homer's seat and also the seat of some of his disciples, and those seats were carved in the local rocks. So Marcellus carries his Odyssey in hand, which he calls this delight and travel guide in Greece. On one occasion, he gets badly lost in the marshlands around Athens, and he's really mad at Homer for not mentioning the marshes that he got lost in. That's how much Homer has to be a geographical guide. And of course, the Homer's Iliad and Odyssey were never written for that purpose. So he says, "I wanted before or else to see the school of Homer and mark the beginning of my journey with an homage to the great poet whose songs had to embellish it and even direct it. That passion for Homer with which my first studies had left me increased during my stay in the Orient. It grew from my observations on the primitive customs, which I approximated to the customs of our own days, from the living applications of the text, from my numerous commentaries, and from the thousands of delight that I owed to the reading of Homer, my favorite pastime. In the end, that passion became some sort of a cult." This is, of course, a cult of Homer, which is also a cult of continuity. The locals are in this picture as confirmation of the ancient text, as confirmation of the applications of the ancient text that can still be confirmed in modern Greek times. So Homer is metonymic for all things ancient Greek. Homer serves as a roadmap to true texts and places. He is a guide and mentor whom Marcellus followed closely in search of meaningful encounters with antiquity's remnants left behind in the physical landscape of what was soon to become independent modern Greece. So Marcellus does not mention local inhabitants here, but when they exist, they're there as keepers of the primitive customs, who he always wants to compare to their Homeric prototypes. So here is our classically trained French royalist who had seen the aftermath of the French Revolution and who himself personally benefited a great deal from the restoration of the Bourbons to the throne. In 1815, Waterloo, at the age of 20, Marcellus had been dispatched to Constantinople to assume the position of secretary to the French embassy there. He was a huge admirer and actually a distant relative of the much more famous Chateaubriand, the romantic traveler. Of course, the latter gained widespread fame, but Marcellus, I think, was actually a better explorer, even though many of the facts behind his stories are somewhat elusive. Also, Marcellus sensed that by the late 1810s already, the Greek territories were stirring themselves for the national uprising against the Ottoman overlords. Yves Le Boucher has brought a new edition of Marcellus's book, which is called Souvenir de l'Orient, in a 2006 edition. The book was written in 1839, and I find this a marvelous edition for a close encounter with our Marcellus. Yves Le Boucher, says about Marcellus, he was one of the last travelers to see the Orient in a kind of primordial state, before an entire part of that dream evaporated in the rubble of the combat, the Greek War of Independence. So, comparing himself to the celebrated Chateaubriand, Marcellus always felt that he's a little bit too late in the game, that he feels that his travel adventures can't have the freshness of a first encounter with the ancient Mediterranean. But here is the solution. If you can't be the first, you can be the last. So he could no longer be the first to experience traveling through the Greek world, but clever Marcellus positioned himself differently and no less authoritatively. If he could not be the first, he could be the last to experience Greece before it changed forever. So this careful repositioning of himself bespeaks something that is useful for me today. It bespeaks the author's full mastery of narrative and dramatizing techniques, which is essentially what he puts to use in his tale of the Venus. He will be the one who turns the Venus from an object into a subject. Yannis Chamilakis had spoken about how locals make subjects of the antiquities. I'm actually adding to that that our French traveler subjectivizes the statue, more so perhaps than the locals. And yes, he does a fair bit of twisting the story. So our Marcellus becomes notorious for abducting the famous Aphrodite that a Greek farmer unearthed in his field on the island of Milos, in what was probably the old Hellenistic gymnasium of Milos. Marcellus not only discovered, but also displayed and dramatized the Venus. He upholds her as a masterpiece of classical sculpture. And it has to be classical, even though, pity for him, she's actually Hellenistic, but that was proven only later. But she has to be classical because the British Museum has the Parthenon marbles, and those are the gold of classical sculptures. So the Venus in the beginning just has to be classical. And that pedestal that was found with her, which actually identifies her as a Hellenistic sculpture, conveniently disappears. So, in his lifelong appreciation of this find, Marcellus transforms the Venus into a collector's prize, and even more, into an object of desire, not only the collector's desire, but even sexual desire as a rhetorical feminine emblem. I have to show you what I think is the picture, the sketch he was first shown. And it's a little bit contested who got the story to him first. I actually give credit to Vautier, who was the better sketcher. And this is indeed the sketch that actually captures something of the artistry of what are essentially two pieces of marble. If you forget about the small pieces that tend to disappear in this story. So our Frenchman was quick to present the Venus as a desirable female captive rescued from an occupied land that is soon going to be war-torn. And because Greece will descend in a revolutionary war, Greece is unprepared and even unworthy to keep her. His dramatization of his Eastern adventure turns the Venus into an endangered statue, and that's a very powerful narrative trope. The captivating and also captive Venus fits the female in peril, damsel in distress trope, a catchphrase and self-serving motivation transferred from an Orientalist to a pre-revolutionary Greek context. This trope of the female in distress is actually all over Orientalist literature and even opera around this time. It suited Marcellus well to apply this literary trope to the Venus and thus to cover up the traces of his own treasure hunting at the expense of what is essentially a feminized, humiliated, and even violated Greece. Marcellus is our Pygmalion, who actually brings in his own subjective mind the statue to life as a sexually attractive woman and plays a very possessive ownership on her. His gendering of the Greek locale, surrounding and suffocating the statue, took on a very detailed, at times graphic description. His writing about his conquest was a form of displaying his classical and therefore Western trophy against the contrastive backdrop of the rest of Greece and the East. Greece lumped in the rest of the East. The Venus was the beautiful white female in danger awaiting rescue, and so was the classical Greek culture, but not the contemporary culture. She was made to represent the West, and the West was eager to reappropriate her. Pre-revolutionary Hellenism was thus subjugated, conquered, possessed in a passive physical and even symbolic sense. It was conquered by the Ottoman Empire, for sure, but also by the West. In post-1815 France would no longer make any significant military or colonial conquests, but it had at least secured a new victory in the manly Marcellus's acquisition of an exquisite Venus. So this manly drive to conquer deflates the perception of all the opponents, rendering them physically and morally weak, essentially emasculating them. Who are these opponents and who are the obstructive locals? Well, first, there is the farmer Yorgos, and if the sources give his name, it will usually be his first name only, Yorgos. He has a last name, but you have to go and look for it, and it may have been Kendrotas. He happened to dig up the two pieces of the Venus, and he's represented as a mere ignorant tool in a chance discovery and transfer, essentially for being easily swayed by a higher bid of money. Some sources say that he quickly covered up the pieces of marble again, and that he probably had the idea of maybe taking it off to the lime kiln. But this is, again, Western speculation. It may just well be that Oriorgos covered up the pieces to take a closer look later on, because there were quite a few foreigners around who were already taking an interest in the statuary of the nearby gymnasium and theater. To use Edem's word, Yorgos is a farmer who is catapulted to fame by a lucky find. But his fame was very short-lived. And then there are the three notables of Milos, whose names, again, we have to go looking for. They are the kind of local authorities, local Greek authorities. They have names. Petros Tatarakis, the Archimandrite Michaelis, and Economos Armenis. Their last names indicate that they actually may have roots in other places. They decide that instead of respecting the bid that was made to our farmer Yorgos by a priest who was acting on behalf of the dragoman Nicolaos Mourousis, that it would be okay for Marcellus to purchase the Venus for more money. So this is a situation in which Marcellus underbids an existing bid negotiated by a priest with a farmer and on which the notables agree. So again, we see the local authorities presented as people with little knowledge and authority, but plenty eager to pocket more money. And then there is that supposedly shady Greek priest or monk by the name of Economos Vergis, who actually features in the Buyuroldu, who had already agreed with Yorgos on a purchase price. And then Marcellus says, well, wait a minute, since the Greeks are the same as the Turks and they never get their act together and they don't act fast enough, I came in, doubled the money, and got the Venus. What's wrong with that? So this rather obscure papas or monk, Vergis, was operating on behalf of Nicolaos Mourousis, the young Greek phanariot from a very cultured background who functioned as dragoman to the Ottoman admiral. Yes, he's presented as a collector, but that brings us to the problem that he then presented. Where is his collection? But he certainly must have had access to a library because he features prominently in a reading of Aeschylus' Persians on the eve of the Greek Revolutionary War, where some of the Greek phanariots get together and read Aeschylus' Persians not as an ancient play only, but as some sort of a historical prediction that they can defeat the new Persians, the Turks, all over again. So ancient tragedy as a modern self-fulfilling prophecy. So there is clearly culture going on in this background, but we don't know about a physical art collection. One thing is true, or Nikolaos Mourouzis is from a prominent family, a prominent Greek family, given a responsible position by the Ottoman administration, and then very often represented as Nikolakis Mourouzis, which is the diminutive little Nikolaos Mourouzis. He was a personal friend of Marcellus, which makes this standoff over the Venus even more problematic, because here is Marcellus presenting him as a rival, a male rival, a sexual rival, another lustful Oriental who wants to keep the Venus to himself as he would with any beautiful Western woman brought to an Eastern harem. So here's Marcellus pulling out all the tropes of what is essentially Oriental harem literature, which was very popular at the time, and the Westerner moving in like the knight in shining armor to rescue the female in peril, and this way motivating his salvation campaign. And then Marcellus gets nasty. He says that Nikolaos Mourouzis, because he has been underbid and the Venus has been taken from him in a fit of what is, of course, typical Oriental anger, subjects the three notables from Milos to a monetary punishment. They have to pay 7,500 piastres, and I now know how much money that is. But also, Marcellus adds the nasty comment that he also subjected the notables of Milos to flogging, to physical punishment. There is no other source of that. He actually admits that he heard the story from hearsay, but it's a nice trope to again bring out the violent, cruel, barbaric nature of Greek or Turk. It doesn't matter at this point. Basically, the non-Westerner. So the Buyuruldu then, issued by the Ottoman Grand Admiral, the Kapodan Pasha, in late October 1820, so a few months after the crisis, reprimands Mourouzis and calls his treatment of the islanders out of line, but emphasizes the monetary punishment. There is no talk about the physical punishment, and I found that discrepancy very telling. And here's what it says. The Drachoman has meddled in the matter of the stone idol, the Venus, which was sold to the French. And on this occasion, he has threatened and insulted the islanders, thus causing them harm. Again, no physical punishment. Even worse, he has used unfitting words against the French. Oh, goodness. I do not approve of the fact that the said Drachoman should threaten and insult you, the islanders, in such a way and use such inappropriate and shameful words against France. Diplomatic crisis, above all. The Drachoman will be forced to return the sums that he has unlawfully taken from you. So it was on Marcellus who likely added the damning detail of Nikolaos Mourouzis cracking himself the whip on the backs of the three notables of Milos and even publicly doing that on another island to publicly shame them. He presented this male Oriental as an irate rival who, he says, has no conception of the value of the Venus. The value of the Venus is only valuable because she cannot belong to Marcellus. He says the Drachmon of the fleet would rather have thrown the statue into the sea rather than see her go to Marcellus. Marcellus hid behind the statement that what he had heard had happened on Milos in the aftermath of his departure with the Venus. After all, again, hearsay, but destructive it's again hearsay, but destructive detail that he himself committed to writing, and thus it stays on the record. The fallout from the purchase of the Venus thus acts as a catalyst, a multiplier with an amplifying effect on the Orientalist master narrative that further diminishes the locals. The Frenchman defined the Ottoman-style tyranny of the Greek morousis through all that was perceived as lacking in the East by the educated West, which ironically proclaimed itself as a West, liberal and philolene, and what is lacking in the East, freedom, progress, rationality, humane conduct, or the very values seen as germane to Western morality and civilization. So Marcellus's own very complex Philhellenism was just configured at the nexus of imperialist politics, Orientalist fantasies, and the Western civilizing mission that has to salvage the statue of classical Greece from what Said has called the emptiness, the black hole of Asia. So these exoticizing scenes and strained excuses must provide justification for Marcellus's wrongful act of undercutting an agreed-upon bid on the Venus and of subsequently hauling the statue onto a French warship with which he had come to Milos. So much for that threat. Thus, an atmosphere of armed struggle, potential armed struggle, and diplomatic scandal, diplomatic crisis, surrounds what Marcellus has referred to as the purchase of the Venus, but what the Greeks have called the robbery, the kidnapping, and the abduction of the statue. The Greek author Miliarakis in 1907 uses the word arpagi, which means a snatching away or an abduction, with even a possible connotation, if you want, of violation and rape. But Miliarakis was actually a rather subjective nationalist Greek historian who does indeed write decades later. He was certainly no Byron. Therefore, the outcry about the abduction of the Venus did not come anywhere near the outcry surrounding Elgin's act of carrying on the Parthenon marbles. And Miliarakis makes another very sinister connection. He implies that the personal and the diplomatic standoff between the French and the Greeks vying, competing for the Venus, followed then by the Ottomans' public embarrassment towards the French, led to the execution of our Nicolas Morousis, who was indeed killed by the Turks in early May of 1821, barely a year later. This insinuation is, of course, the voice of the local Greeks, but it's likely not valid. Morousis is not a direct victim of the French intrigues. What happened is that at the outbreak of the Greek Revolution, the Ottomans retaliated against all the prominent Greeks to whom they had given very powerful positions, but from whom they also expected that they would keep a lid on the Greek Revolution. As soon as the Greek Revolution breaks out, they feel betrayed by the very hand that people they've been feeding, let's say. Some Greek amateur historian has made a lot of the physical struggle for the possession of the Venus statue that happened in the harbor of Milos, to show you that this story of a violent scuffle between the locals and the Turks did not easily go away. Let me refer to a strange source, a Facebook post from February 2019. I don't credit any value to it, other than that I like to see how some of these stories live on. The author relocates the scuffle, the physical struggle, from the harbor of Milos to the harbor of Piraeus, no less, and he has the Ottoman armed forces retaliate against supposedly 1,000 Greeks who had gathered there to reclaim the Venus as part of their heritage. And no less than 200 Greeks lost their lives in the struggle, and the Venus lost her arms. None of this ever happened. There is no source for it. But I like how the story becomes kind of a fish story, right? The fish becomes bigger as you go on. Marcellus, when not stressing the monetary transaction that had to whitewash what really happened, uses the word enlèvement. He took along the Venus, driven by an overwhelming desire to own her, and he secured the statue's transport to Paris, where it would remain forever protected from certain demise. I like to show you what needed to be done to the Venus in the Second World War to make sure that she stayed protected. Here she is all crated up to be to make sure that she doesn't fall victim to the German occupation. So safety is relative, is what I'm saying. Yet Marcel's stubborn possessiveness, thinly disguised as a concern for the classical Greek legacy, ruined a valuable friendship and certainly jeopardized a network of diplomatic relations. After leaving Milos and before handing off the statue to his superior, the French ambassador, Marcellus first took the Venus on a tour. And I like this because this is probably the only kind of show-off tour of an antiquity that has been recently found and that is still shown off in the Eastern Mediterranean rather than rushed to a Western location. This is, of course, a tour that overlaps with his diplomatic mission and it covers Rhodes, Cyprus, Lebanon, Alexandria, and Athens. The immediate effect of this five-month-long sea voyage was not that more locals get to see her. It was rather that it breaks up the ties between the statue and the local soil from which she comes. By the time she arrives in Paris, she is just, she's been everywhere. The now far from stationary Venus acquired her own virtual travelogue within Marcellus's travelogue, and she gained her own European audience, no less, of connoisseurs who happen to live in the Eastern Mediterranean. Of course, among them is the notorious antiquarian Fauvel, whom you have heard a lot about. In Athens, Marcellus contacts Fauvel because he wants Fauvel's approval. And sure enough, he calls out Fauvel one moonlit night to the harbor of Piraeus so that the statue doesn't have to be unloaded. She stays on the ship. And sure enough, Fauvel thinks she is of exquisite beauty. And that's the first time that Marcellus realizes it was all worth it. It needed the stamp of approval of the connoisseur of the days. He did not have that judgment of his own quite yet. When the statue finally arrives in Paris in February of 1821, she is placed in the Louvre to be seen and appreciated as a French possession, ironically within weeks of the outbreak of the Greek Revolution. Marcellus created a culture of display by this tour, as well as a literary culture surrounding the Venus, through his dramatic travel writings that reduced all the locals to stagehands and extras. On repeated occasions throughout his life, Marcellus wrote and published about the Venus several times over, and he kept dramatizing the tale to impress upon the reader and to direct the gaze of the viewer as a museum guide would do. The results show how central authoritative narrative can become to the interpretation of a work of art. The absence of any history prior to the artwork's discovery facilitates this spectacularization of the statue. And it makes of the owner and his find the primary agents, and it obliterates any subaltern agency. So Marcellus's act of writing is a form of displaying the Venus against the dark Eastern Mediterranean, the dark Orient. Marcel's travel narrative becomes a narrative as well as a plot. All these little occasions on which he shows off the Venus to connoisseurs in the Eastern Mediterranean become display acts, often conducted discreetly and secretly in harbors and by special invitation. They become set stage pieces. The passing of time, the travel distance, and these furtive viewings without any locals present become part of the Frenchman mapping of the Eastern Mediterranean, with the beacon of the Venus steering him as he sets west and east, west and local, even further apart. Marcellus paraded the Venus as his own culture's, French culture's, firm connection to the West, and he paraded the otherness and the Oriental regions as the backdrop as he visited. In this symbolic as well as literal circumnavigation, the classics and the imperialist owners of the classic help to mark the territory of the West and to demarcate its contours. Thus, the dramatic and the triumphant tour of the Venus gives new meaning to what Said has defined as the vast area of the Orient's imaginative geography. It's a geography without many specifics, in which a diplomatic mission, a triumphal procession, and a real geography merge. Marcellus collects sports, admirers, picturesque episodes, all for an imaginative geography of the Venus's display tour. And he was thereby imagining his find for a public back home whose appetite for the classical as well of the Oriental kept growing. So this is where the fashion of the Oriental and the fashion of the classical really quite handsomely meet each other in this dramatized travelogue. Marcel's sense of proprietorship actually never goes away, and neither does his obsession with display. It continued to define his relationship to the Venus long after she had been donated and displayed in the Louvre, where she was first put in a small and somber vault. Boasting now that he himself unearthed the Venus, an act in which he had no dealings at all, Marcellus then dictates and complains to the Louvre that she needed unearthing, exhuming a second time from a second entombment. The entombment now in the 19th century dark French museum. It hurt the savior to see the mistreatment no less, of the sculpture that marked his own royalist loyalties, but significantly France's cultural capital. So the ownership of a work of art for everyone to see, everyone in the West to see, stands, of course, for so much more than economic and financial capital. The Venus now embodies the cultural and largely symbolic capital of a France that has grown newly confident after the first few years of the Restoration. The restoration of eye-catching ancient art to the Louvre gave material expression to the restoration of the Bourbon throne and to a new conservatism that had ensued since 1815. Of course, this comes in a very timely manner because France had to give back the Venus de Medici and the Apollo Belvedere after Napoleon's defeat. So the Venus is especially welcome. Precisely because the Louvre displayed France's royalist capital, it had to give visitors the best possible chance to witness a visual icon of such power. Marcellus' story, therefore, presents a very subjective investment in the Venus's earliest modern appearance, and it lays bare many more sociopolitical forces than artistic or aesthetic concerns. Marcellus covered up important parts of the truths surrounding the Venus. The truth may just have gotten in the way of a good story. Thus, the Frenchman proclaimed that Hellenism unmasked its unmasked itself as an Orientalism, eager to lump Greece back into that inert, dangerous, and corrupt mass that was the Ottoman Empire. In the West's predatory views, Greece was a treasure trove betokened by the Venus sexualized matter, but Marcellus's memoirs vividly illustrate an international chase for antiquities, which fuels hostile standoffs to this day. I will skip a little part here, but I want to add to that Marcellus at some point in his travelogue does take an interest into the local girls of Chios, the island of Chios, which he describes in another chapter. He remembers how he meets the girls of Chios, and then he doesn't quite dwell on the local inhabitants, but quickly predicts that Chios will be the subject of the massacre by the Turks. And so again, this little personal encounter with the girls of Chios frames the encounter with the Venus, because here's again the superior Frenchman, the Frenchman with superior knowledge, who dramatizes the encounter for the sake of his own story and history. This little encounter with the girls of Chios too had to instill France's supremacy for positing superior knowledge, even foresight into impending disasters and shifting power relations in the Eastern Mediterranean. I will move to my conclusion now. The Hellenism that Marcellus boasted of saving had to be strictly classical to be compelling. Marcellus was enamored with an ideal of Greece that was unrealistic and outdated by the start of the 19th century. His peregrinations in time, space, narrative, and drama exemplify the West's search for Greeks and Greeks in their classical image, and the disappointing discovery of a local Greece that he then profiled as sub-Western, inferior to the West. The writer's revolutionary sympathies, which he did have, and actually did lend some support to Greece's revolutionary struggle, did not extend to accepting and protecting, let alone setting free, a viable Hellenism for the modern Greeks. The Greeks did populate the narratives of literati and artists, but they always still have to prove themselves. They had to be sufficiently classical to counterbalance the Orientalist image that would otherwise be associated with them, and to be deserving of Western support through their armed insurgency. Modern Greeks had to demonstrate that within a few decades and contacts with the West, they could become as classical and as civilized as Western Europeans had supposedly been for centuries. In the fervor of the revolutionary age, an antagonistic thinking between the sullen, violent, and tyrannical Eastern enemy came to serve all parties. Even the revolutionaries of 1821 draw on the classical background to make themselves more worthy recipients of aid from Russia, France, and Britain, which could otherwise only reluctantly be convinced to join the struggle for the cause of a Christian Greece. It is not so much about the Christian Greece. It is about the Christian Greece that actually has the classical antiquities. The Greek Revolution then entails a revolving back to past history, and I play with the words revolution, revolving back, and a tenacious investment in cultural, linguistic, and ethnic continuity, and a fierce denial of racial mixing. Consequently, modern Greece came about as a restorative act, and an act always on display. Modern Greece came about as a purification process as well, purified of local occupants, local time, local space, even of a racial threat. A process that could never viably claim to be entirely pure, let alone disinterested. The West, Greece, and the Orient were far from closed or autonomous entities, and our study can help us better comprehend how interrelated they were by examining processes of exchange, narrative diplomacy, commerce, and even complicity. Against this broader and tangled backdrop, the statue's story matters because it qualifies today's critical concerns with the West's quest for continuity, its own continuity, and its representational and practical dominion over various Eastern others, from Turks to Greeks to chunks of marble. Thank you.